It is Tuesday, October 9th, 2012. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Callums.
And I'm Antoinette Grajeda. Support for KUAF comes from Walton Art Center and the 10x10 Art Series, featuring the Tokyo String Quartets on Friday, October 19th at 8 p.m. The award-winning chamber ensemble will perform music from Haydn, Kodály, and Ravel as part of their final tour before retirement. Tickets and more information available at waltonartcenter.org or 443-5600.
AETN, Fayetteville Public Library, and KUAF invite the public to a free screening of As Goes Janesville as part of Community Cinema Sunday, October 14th at 2 p.m. at the Fayetteville Public Library. In this film, jobs disappear, families are stretched to their breaking point, and citizens and politicians fight over how to turn things around. AETN.com/community cinema for more information.
Ahead on this edition of Ozarks, Roy Reed covered the South for the New York Times in the 1960s and 70s, and his job gave him a front seat to the civil rights movement, hurricanes, and later the White House. His new memoir of his New York Times career, Beware of Limbo Dancers, has just been published by the University of Arkansas Press. Kyle talks to him about the book on this edition of Ozarks at Large.
But first, construction is underway on another piece of the 36-mile Razorback Regional Greenway. Last week, the cities of Fayetteville and Johnson broke ground on Clear Creek Trail, a 3-mile trail segment that will pass through the two towns. While it is currently possible for trail users to navigate from Mud Creek Trail to the trails at the lake, Fayetteville City Trails Coordinator Matt Mihalovich says that the new trail will provide a safer route.
One of the nice things it does is provides a true trail experience, well, throughout the town, really, because it just expands the whole network of trails. But currently, you have to go along a bike lane on Vantage Road to get to Lake Fayetteville, and you do have to cross Zion and Joy Streets. This particular trail will actually go underneath all of the adjacent streets and roads, including Gregg and Wilkerson Street and 71B. So there will not be any road crossings with this trail. It'll be all just off-street trail. So I think that's really one of the unique elements of this particular piece of trail.
The trail will start at the junction of Skull Creek and Mud Creek Trails. At that point, the trail will head north, turn east, north of the Northeast Arkansas Mall, and head east following Clear Creek. Mihalovich says that the trail is being paid for with grant funding allotted to the overall Greenway project, and that construction should be complete in about a year's time.
From trails to crosswalks, tomorrow is the 9th annual Crosswalk Safety Awareness Day in Fayetteville. Throughout the day, drivers will be reminded that they are required by state law to stop for pedestrians at crosswalks, as signs will be posted at crosswalks across town. Paula Marinoni is the event's organizer.
The signs are big, and they're bright yellow and bright red, which anybody in marketing can tell you that's what you get people's attention with. Big, bold letters on the signs, Crosswalk Safety Awareness Day. So people hold the signs, or we put them in the ground, so that when traffic passes, you don't have to turn your head to look at it. You can barely, you know, look out of the corner of your eye. So we don't want to distract traffic, but we want people to see it.
Marinoni says she initiated the event 9 years ago after moving back to Fayetteville, and she realized drivers didn't necessarily abide by the rules when it came to crosswalks.
I remember one time I was trying to cross Dixon Street, and I was pushing a stroller with my, you know, about a 2-year-old in it, and I was looking in the eyes of traffic passing by us, and it took 24 cars before one would stop for us.
Marinoni says the annual event serves as a good reminder and helps to keep drivers trained to stop at crosswalks.
Drivers in Fayetteville should be aware that beginning today, the city is closing Oakland Avenue between Holly and Lawson Streets. According to the city, the closure is necessary to install a drainage pipe. The street will be closed between 7:30 a.m. and 3 p.m., and construction should take just a few days.
Expansion plans at the Rogers Historical Museum are moving along. When the Rogers City Council meets tonight, the council is expected to approve a more than $100,000 contract between the museum and Hazlip Studio of Memphis for design work related to two permanent exhibitions. Gabe Land, executive director of the Rogers Historical Museum, says museum officials were impressed by the studio's design work.
Well, we planned for this, the permanent exhibits in the new facility that we're working on, to be extremely interactive and to have a lot of hands-on components. And they have actually started out working in, although they now do other types of museums, but their very first museum projects were children's museums. And they have a lot of experience with those and also with the nature centers. They were the designers of the Janet Huckabee Center down in Fort Smith, for example.
The contract would have the firm design two exhibits. One of those exhibits will be called Our Natural State and will focus on the impact of natural forces, resources, and landforms on the lives of people in this area over time and in the present day, including interactive elements such as a tornado machine and a bluff shelter with an attle-attle throw hunting activity. The other exhibit will focus on the White River and its role in our area's economic and social life, incorporating interaction through a flooding valley model and hydroelectric power demonstration. Bland says even though the architectural designs are not finalized for the facility's expansion, the museum is starting to design the exhibits to get ahead on such a large project.
It's going to take us a lot of time with our staff to do our part of it, first of all, and second, it's really important before you get to the stage where you do the final architectural plans. We have a plan, a footprint and a floor plan and spaces, but we aren't to the point where people are putting in electrical outlets and those sorts of issues. It's really important to have your exhibit design in place before the architects really finalize the blueprints of a project like this, because only then do they know what the needs are going to be for electrical and mechanical and so on.
If you're curious about the future plans for the Rogers Historical Museum, an exhibit detailing those plans opened at the museum in August.
Partly cloudy tonight, lows in northwest Arkansas in the lower 40s. Arkansas River Valley should have a low near 50. Tomorrow, partly cloudy, highs in the lower 70s. And for Wednesday night, clouds, 20% chance of rain, possibly a thunderstorm. Lows in northwest Arkansas about 41, a low in the Arkansas River Valley of about 55.
Arkansas politics are heating up with less than a month to go until Election Day. Legislative races are getting contentious, and Republicans, Democrats, and Governor Mike Beebe are all involved in the mix. Bloggers Michael Cook with Cook's Outlook blogs from the Democrats' perspective, while Jason Tolbert with the Tolbert Report blogs from the Republican point of view. Recently, the two bloggers spoke with Roby Brock from our content partner, TalkBusiness.net. They began the conversation by discussing recent poll results.
Let's begin with the presidential race, which Arkansas 6 electoral votes are not going to be too undecided before election night. We've got Mitt Romney 55.5%, Barack Obama 34.5%. The Republicans are going to try to tie every Democrat in the state to Barack Obama. Will it work?
I don't think so, because Democrats are tying themselves to Governor Mike Beebe, who's extremely popular. And the thing about these local legislative races, Democrats are part of the community. They're the high school principal. They're the business owner. They're the people who've been around a long time. So some of the Republicans will try to attempt to tie them to Obama. I don't think it'll be successful because they're tying themselves to Mike Beebe instead.
What about on the congressional level?
Congressional level, it's tougher because there are federal issues. But of course, we'll talk about polling in a minute, the Democrats aren't doing so hot without Obama in a factor or not a factor,
right,
on that level.
What do you think, Jason? Does the Obama tie to the Democrats in general, does it work as a campaign strategy?
To some degree, I think it does. I think a lot of the voters this year, when they go to the polls, they'll be looking primarily at the presidential race. They'll be going to vote for either for Mitt Romney or for Barack Obama. And I think, as we saw, most of them will be voting in the Republican column at the top of the ticket. So it's going to be a challenge for the candidates down the ballot to get voters then to switch to a different party once they get a couple races down into the ballot. It can be done. We've seen that happen many times in the past in the state. But it's going to be a challenge they're going to have to overcome.
Are they voting for Mitt Romney or are they voting against Barack Obama?
I think a lot of people, when an incumbent president is in office, it's a referendum on the job that he's done. And I think that Obama right now, at least in Arkansas, is losing that referendum. I don't think he's proven that he's done a good job the last 4 years. He didn't do very well here in 2008. I think he'll probably do even worse this time around.
We talk a little bit about how historically Arkansans have split tickets before. You've talked about that a lot in the past, but we didn't see that necessarily in 2010.
We didn't see that in 2010, but since 1972, Arkansas, with the exception of when Bill Clinton ran two times and Jimmy Carter has run in 76, we've always voted Republican on the national level. So Arkansas has a history of splitting tickets. In 2004, George Bush beat John Kerry in Arkansas, but then Arkansans voted for Senator Blanche Lincoln over Republicans. So we have a long history of splitting our tickets. That's just kind of how we are. We kind of vote for the person, not for the individual, once you start getting down the ballot.
Question for both of y'all. Do you think that if in 2012 we do see a similar election result to what we saw in 2010, is it safe at that point in time to say that there is a paradigm shift going on in the voting electorate in Arkansas?
Yeah, I think what you're seeing is Arkansas is catching up with a lot of our neighbors, a lot of other southern states that have seen that paradigm shift play out in the 90s, a decade or so ago. In Arkansas, really because of some strong personalities in the Democratic Party, such as Bill Clinton, allowed that shift to be delayed. And we're just now seeing that start to catch up. Now, is that a permanent shift? That's another question. And I think we'll have to see if Republicans do take the majority in the legislature, how they govern once they finally get that majority, as whether they can hold that or not. But I think we're seeing that paradigm shift slowly catch up in Arkansas.
Now, I don't want to jump to the legislature just yet, because sure, I'm going to come to that with another line of questioning. But what do you think? Do you think it is a paradigm shift if we see it in two election cycles in a row?
Potentially so, yes. I mean, obviously, both the Democrats and Republicans are fighting hard to keep control or retain control of the state legislature. So this could be a tipping point election one way or the other. Of course, we'll know on November 6th exactly what happens.
Right. Well, really, on November 7th.
Exactly.
Okay, let's shift to other numbers that we just released poll results on, and that is Governor Mike Beebe. It's not a big surprise. We've seen him in the stratosphere really throughout his entire term of office, much to the Republicans' chagrin, much to the Democrats' benefit there. He's still in the stratosphere. Does he have coattails?
I think he has serious coattails. Arkansans like Governor Mike Beebe. Even Republicans, our polling has showed, like Governor Mike Beebe. And he is out there, you know, crisscrossing the state, fighting for Democratic legislative candidates. And legislative candidates are tying themselves to Mike Beebe. Now, of course, again, we'll know on November 6th if it works. But because Beebe is so popular and Democrats are tying themselves to his agenda and some of the things that he wants to do to keep moving our state forward, I think it is going to pay big dividends on Election Day.
What do you think from the Republican perspective?
Well, I think we're going to have to see how involved he gets. I think there are definitely certain areas where he will help more than other areas. In the central Arkansas area, I think we saw his numbers were extremely high. So I think we'll see him get involved in some of those races, and there's definitely some hot races in that region. As you get further away from the central part of the state, down to the southern part of the state, over in the eastern part of the state, those numbers sort of diminished a little bit.
It's kind of a surprise because those are areas where Democrats and even Mike Beebe have typically been pretty strong, and he was still strong there, but
right,
he was stronger in the third congressional district than he was in the first or the fourth. That's a surprise.
Sure, and I think really what you saw there is we're starting to see the more rural parts of the state are becoming the Republican areas, where in the past those were Democrat areas. And those counties, those regions have almost flipped now to being Republican strongholds. And so I think that's really going to be a new dynamic this election that we haven't seen in the past. You get into the central Arkansas area, and things haven't shifted quite as fast as we've seen in some other areas.
Is the rural part of the state becoming a Republican stronghold?
It's always been conservative. Again, this is one of those things we'll know more on Election Day. I still think Democrats are doing well. A lot of these individual races, they're putting up good fights, and I think it'll pay off because they're doing the right things. They are, you know, Arkansas Democrats have always been naturally conservative. That's just who we are all across the state, with maybe one or two exceptions in some small legislative districts in Little Rock or Fayetteville. So Arkansas voters know that Arkansas Democrats are conservative. They share the same values as everyday Arkansans.
Yeah, but I think that's going to get more difficult now for Democrats to make the case this year, because people are seeing on the nationalization of politics, and you're seeing that all over the country. Politics is getting more nationalized.
Yeah,
and you're seeing
it's always been national, but the Arkansas Democrats have always consistently been moderate to conservative. That's been our long history. We support gun rights. We support making sure our public education system is strong. We support small businesses. That's just who we are. You know, you can talk about national Democrats and what they do in D.C. or New York City. Arkansans don't care. You know, what is the woman who's running for state rep in my district, how does she stand? That's what I want to know. Or the man running for state senate in my area, you know, Democrat or Republican, we want to know what they stand for. We don't care what the congressman from California or senator from Texas feel. So politics always remains local when it comes to Arkansas politics.
But I think it's going to be more difficult for them to almost apologize for what their national party is doing. When you have to make excuses for a national party is much different than I am, that puts you in a difficult position, on a defensive position to begin with.
It's always been that way. Like I said, since 1972, Republicans have always won Arkansas. The only time Democrat has ever won Arkansas presidential presidential has been Bill Clinton and Jimmy Carter once. So we have this history of, all right, the National Democrats are one thing, but we're completely different, which is why Mike Beebe won all 75 counties 2 years ago in a time when the Republicans had the tsunami, and yet he held strong, even won Benton County, one of the most Republican counties in the country. So that kind of shows that people can figure out the difference between local Democrats and national Democrats.
Well, we'll see if that plays out. We'll see if Obama is a different dynamic this year, too, because we've seen attempts to tie Democrats to Nancy Pelosi or Newt Gingrich that have not been as successful as it would appear. Obama has been a very successful albatross for Democrats in like the 2010 election.
But you also have to look at, I think, where voters are getting their information from. I think we see more people watching more national programs such as Fox News, such as, you know, all the online news sources now, and maybe not relying as heavily on some of the local media sources. And so I think that kind of skews a bit how fast that nationalization has taken place.
Robbie Brock of TalkBusiness.net talked with bloggers Jason Tolbert of The Tolbert Report and Michael Cook of Cook's Outlook. Support for TalkBusiness.net on Ozarks at Large is provided by Mitchell Williams Law, providing strategic counsel on a variety of sophisticated legal matters since 1954. Mitchell Williams Law Firm combines decades of diverse professional experience to clients across the U.S. Today, the firm employs nearly 80 attorneys from four offices in Arkansas, Texas, and New York. Online at MitchellWilliamsLaw.com.
And Bank of the Ozarks, committed to helping business owners succeed by combining the tools and services businesses need with accessible experience and knowledge. More information at BankOzarks.com. And Verizon, offering a wide selection of productivity-enhancing tablets for small business, including the Apple iPad. More information at a Verizon Communications store near you or online at vzw.com/smallbusiness. And CEG Partners, using empirical data to better understand your customers' experiences and their loyalties. More information at cegpartners.com.
You've got dinner table discussion, water cooler chat, even pillow talk, but how often are you part of the national conversation? I'm Neil Conan. Raise your voice on everything from the news of the day to the twists and turns of culture and history on Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Talk of the Nation this afternoon at 1 on KUAF 91.3 FM.
For more than 20 years, Roy Reed was a newspaper reporter for the Arkansas Gazette and then the New York Times. He was hired by the Times to cover the southern United States and reported on the civil rights movement, hurricanes, and politics. Later, he reported from the White House, the presidential campaign trail, and from London as the Times correspondent there. His new book, Beware of Limbo Dancers, A Correspondent's Adventures with the New York Times, is a memoir of his days with the Times, but also the Gazette, and a bit about his childhood and adolescence in Hot Springs and the Ouachita Mountains. Roy now lives in Hawkeye, and last week he came to the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio to talk about the book published by the University of Arkansas Press. He writes in Beware of Limbo Dancers that he was not quite the Southerner that Northerners imagined.
I was a hill fellow, not a delta fellow in broad terms. I couldn't really speak the language. Well, you hear what I sound like. I sound more like maybe Lyndon Johnson than, you know, Senator, what's his name, from Mississippi or Alabama. And I write a little bit about the difference in the language from the upland South and the deep South, and have a little fun with that. But I was, you know, I did not grow up in anything like a plantation society. And I think that's probably, or in those days at least, back in the 60s, that was the national image of a Southerner, a white Southerner especially. Somebody from Georgia maybe, Louisiana maybe. And those of us up on the fringe, western northern Arkansas, I grew up in Hot Springs, we didn't fit that image. And I think that's what I wanted to make clear.
When you were first with the Times and you're traveling about, you mentioned that you discovered this in your previous days with the Gazette, that a reporter's day starts slowly, then builds to a crescendo around deadline.
Oh, yes. You know that feeling. And there's nothing quite like the rush. And sometimes you feel good about it, and sometimes you just want to pull your hair out. the worst days are when you you have too much to do in too short a time, and so and you learn to just hammer it out. We had two or three guys at the Gazette, and they were all guys in this general assignment category, who could just write as fast as they could think. I mean, and incredible typists, like 90 words a minute, something mm-hmm. like that, on these old Underwood typewriters. I was never built for that, for speed of any kind, to tell the truth. And that's the worst, when you have too many stories to get in before the deadline, which is usually about 6:30 or 7. And the second worst thing is being stuck for a lead on a story, the first paragraph or two or three. And those of us who struggle over our writing anyway always found that finding the right lead was the hardest part. And I've known other reporters who would write a lead, rip it out of the typewriter, throw it in the wastebasket, write another and another, and ended up with half a dozen leads thrown away before they found one that suited them. But, yeah, it all comes to a head just before deadline. And then when the deadline passes and you can relax, I suspect that that period of time before and after the deadline accounts for a lot of the hard drinking that used to happen in newspapers. There's a line in one of Chris Christopherson's songs that goes like, whether it's the going up is worth the coming down. And you wonder about that. But coming down is an important part of it, and you have to learn how to handle the coming down, just as you have to learn the going up before the deadline.
And I guess when there are many of you coming down together, alcohol could even be easier.
Oh, yeah.
Because
you've
got this sort of
yeah, it is
camaraderie.
And the single guys would all just head en masse to a particular bar that they all favored. And in Little Rock, there were two or three favorite bars over the years. We married fellas almost never went with them. Or if any of the married guys did, they were usually in trouble at home.
Not a good gang to hang out with.
No, not a good gang to hang. But we manage it, and it's hard on marriages, newspaper work is, or used to be. I guess it still is. And that's just one of the reasons. The reporter gets home, and he's still kind of strung up and needing to do something to get past that. And if there's anything, any piddling thing going on with your wife or your kids, or your nowadays with your husband and your mm-hmm. kids, then you're likely to blow a fuse instead of handling it calmly. So it's and that's one reason that reporters often burn out. Mm-hmm. It's very unusual for reporters to last until old age in the trade. I've known only two or three of all the years I spent in newspapering, and I never quite figured out what kept those people going. In one case, I can be pretty certain it was anger. Old Morton Mintz of the Washington Post woke up mad every day and went to bed mad over some outrage that some bureaucrat had done or some corporation had pulled, and that kept him going. But that's kind of rare. Most reporters end up doing either some less demanding part of newspapering. They become an editor, a copy editor, or this, that. Or they just shuck it all and get into public relations or, in my case, teaching.
Right. Well, when you were with the Gazette, you would file your stories, type them up, I would imagine, generally in a newsroom. When you were the Southern correspondent or the White House correspondent for the Times, you would have been filing away from an office. In the 1960s, how did you – if you're in Selma, how did you file a story to meet deadline?
That was one of the very hardest parts of the thing, and purely logistical. Nowadays, there are all kinds of ways to file. You carry a laptop that's plugged into this, that, the other, back, and you just write your story and push a button, and it goes off into the ether, and And the next step is some editor grabs it and starts editing. But back then, you had to find a telephone. Sometimes that was easy. At Selma, for example, I had a room at the Albert Hotel, and it had a telephone. And if I had time, and usually I did, I could scamper back to the hotel a few blocks away and just to pick up the phone and get the recording room on 43rd Street in New York and speak the story, you know, talk it slowly. That could be a lot of fun sometimes. These are New Yorkers at the other end, and I was not a New Yorker. But that was the logistics of the thing. Now, the hard ones are you're away from any population center. There are no telephones nearby. Or you may be in a town, but you're having to rely on a payphone at a phone booth. And all the other reporters who might be with you are scrambling for the same phones. There used to be some kind of famous stories about reporters literally coming to blows for the telephone. The old UPI guy who beat the AP correspondent to the story when John Kennedy was killed. He literally took the phone away from him in the press car following the motorcade. And the AP guy was beating him on the back and the head, trying to get him to...
Literally beating him.
Literally beating him. And Smith wouldn't give it up. But that's pretty rare. But mainly just struggling to find a phone. One time, I was covering Hurricane Camille, and there were no phones within 50 miles of the Gulf Coast where it hit the hardest. And I had to drive north first to get... because the roads were blocked going east to west. I had to drive north in Mississippi to Hattiesburg, which is about close to 100 miles from the coast, and then back south to the coast with very little time to do any reporting on the scene, and then head back up the road to find a working telephone. That might have been the worst experience I had, but it was a problem.
So you wouldn't, in an extreme situation like that, I'm imagining you did not have time to sit down at a typewriter and type, you would have to just dictate from your notes on the phone?
Good question. The old wire service reporters could do it off the top of their head. And in fact, some of the most amazing performances I've ever seen were on the White House beat much later, where they would have to literally run from the press room back to the one end of the White House to the other, to get to their telephones, and they would grab their phone, which would be an open line, and just start talking into the phone. Leads perfectly formed in their heads. I never understood how to do that. I always had to at least write out with a pencil and pad the first paragraph or two. And then now and then, I didn't have time to compose the whole thing, but on a typewriter, I had to just talk it. And that's a separate skill, one that reporters, I suspect, don't have to learn these days.
Well, of course, in radio, and just about everyone who reports now can record something. And you write of a time when you were covering a eulogy that Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. gave. And you said it was one of the most eloquent things you've ever heard. But you and other reporters, because no one was recording, you had to get together and say, is this what we heard? You wanted to get every word right.
That's right. And we settled on what we thought was our best reckoning on what he had actually, his exact words. And, of course, years later, all reporters were carrying recorders, and some of them pretty bulky machines. But back then, we were on our own.
Roy Reed is the author of the new book, Beware of Limbo Dancers, A Correspondent's Adventures with the New York Times. We'll hear more from the conversation in just a moment, including his reporting on the day police lobbed tear gas at civil rights marchers at the Pettus Bridge in Selma, Alabama. That's in just a moment on this edition of Ozarks at Large.
Thank you.
This is Ozarks at Large. We continue with our conversation with Roy Reed, author of Beware of Limbo Dancers, A Correspondent's Adventures with the New York Times, published by the University of Arkansas Press. Roy spent more than 20 years as a newspaper reporter, including years covering the southern United States for the New York Times. He was one of the reporters at the Edmund Pettus Bridge in Selma, Alabama, on Bloody Sunday, March 7, 1965, when Alabama State Troopers, armed with billy clubs and tear gas, attacked civil rights marchers. When you were covering something that was happening right there in front of your eyes, I'm thinking about the incident at the Pettus Bridge with the march, where tear gas is lobbed at civil rights marchers, and there is this wedge of billy club wielding law enforcement officers beating people. How do you get that into a lead paragraph and a newspaper article?
Would you like for me to read that paragraph?
That would be wonderful.
If you can find it.
Let's see.
While you're looking for that, I might throw in that the tear gas there choked up television people, reporters, newspaper reporters, the marchers, everybody except the law enforcement people who had gas masks. And if you've ever breathed tear gas, I don't have to describe what it's like. It's very nearly unbearable.
Well, when you described it in the book, what really hit home was you were talking about how you couldn't breathe, your eyes are tearing. But the worst part is then realizing you're completely vulnerable to whatever comes next.
Absolutely, yeah. You can't see and you can't breathe. Yeah, there you're just standing in the target. And that was just the reporters.
Yeah, who did not take the brunt of
that's
the...
right. The people who really suffered were the marchers. Who. But you ask, how do you come up with a lead? Well, this is what I came up with on... not in the lead, but the just a few paragraphs down, where I felt I had to describe what it looked like and felt like and tasted like. It went like this: the wedge. That was a wedge of state troopers and sheriff's people on horseback with horse whips and billy clubs. The wedge moved with such force that it seemed almost to pass over the waiting column instead of through it. The first 10 or 20 Negroes were swept to the ground screaming, arms and legs flying, and packs and bags went skittering across the grassy divider strip and onto the pavement on both sides. Those still on their feet retreated. A cheer went up from the white spectators lining the south side of the highway. Then came the pop of a tear gas canister, and a venomous cloud covered the highway. Through the mist, I heard coughing, the sound of clubs on flesh and bone, and cries of pain. The men on horses sped through the fleeing marchers, wielding whips on faces, backs, and legs. The spectators whooped and cheered. And then I add on my own in the book, I hope never again to see such hatred in the eyes of men, women, and, yes, children.
When you write about that incident, and it's in the New York Times, I'm imagining when you're dictating that or getting that into the paper, you're not thinking about the fact that so many – or maybe you are. So many people are going to see this, and I guess you are. The responsibility you have as a reporter to tell people exactly what happened. Although there were television stations and this is very famous video now, but the responsibility to get it right.
Well, yeah, and especially in if you're working for one of the big national papers, the Times, the Washington Post, the L.A. Times, the Christian Science Monitor in those days, the Wall Street Journal, we all felt that responsibility. I should say that in the case of that incident at Selma, Alabama, on March the 7th, 1965. I would like to take credit for helping to arouse the nation's anger and conscience, but the truth is it was the television broadcasts that did it. Beginning on the evening newscasts that night and the next day, over and over, they showed this horrible scene that had unfolded there in an American city against American citizens. And it was revolting. And the typical response of people who saw that on television was, this is terrible. Why do we put up with this? And enough of those angry citizens let their public officials know how they felt, that the immediate result of that incident was to lead, in a matter of weeks, to the passage of the Voting Rights Act of 1965. And you could trace it in a direct line. There was no doubt at all what had sparked that national revulsion that caused that voting, and we're still using that Voting Rights Act today.
When it's a big story about like civil rights issue, and you saw trial after trial where people who it was somewhat obvious had beaten or murdered people and would be acquitted. And you saw also a quick progress in advancement when the Voting Rights Act was passed. Did you ever have to battle cynicism?
No. Oddly enough, I never did feel cynical. I felt a lot of anger, occasionally sadness. Anger most often at the miscarriages of justice in particular. And I think first of all of a case I actually wrote about in the book, a fellow named Tom Coleman, a leading citizen of Lowndes County, Alabama, worked for the county government. And when I say a leading citizen, I mean an old family, as they like to say in Alabama. Family went back generations on the land there. This guy's sister was, I think, this school superintendent. And he one day just casually walked up to a grocery store that had a front porch. And when what they called an outside agitator walked out on the porch, a white fellow, a minister, Coleman just raised his shotgun and shot him dead. And he was brought to trial. You know, they went through the formality of an arrest, and it meant nothing because he was never convicted, and everybody in that little old town knew that he had never be convicted. All of Alabama understood that. But that was just an accepted way of doing business. There were enforcers in a lot of these little old towns who were they considered it a kind of civic duty to keep the black folks down, to keep them in their place, to uphold white supremacy, the age-old way that things had been done. And I don't think any of them were ever convicted of crime. As I say, it was considered a kind of civic duty.
And you call it the newest lost cause,
this
sort of white supremacy that was existing.
That's right, yeah.
You write, sometimes when you're looking back at some of your writing, you say that you smarted off in your writing.
Probably did.
You, and using your term, smarted off, there's one time in Beware of Limbo Dancers that you still get a new smarting off. You talk about one of these people who was eventually convicted of murder decades later and sentenced to 80 years in jail. And you write, he will be 140 when he's released, barring health complications.
Yes, I admit it. I enjoyed writing that line.
Roy, thank you very much for your time.
You're very welcome.
Roy Reed's new book is Beware of Limbo Dancers, A Correspondent's Adventures with the New York Times, published by the University of Arkansas Press. He'll discuss the book tomorrow night at Giffords Auditorium in Old Main on the University of Arkansas campus as part of a celebration of faculty authors. That event begins tomorrow night at 7. He'll also speak at the U of A Global Campus just off the Fayetteville Square Thursday afternoon at 2 in conjunction with the Osher Lifelong Learning Institute. And he'll speak at the Fayetteville Public Library November 15th. You can also hear more from our conversation in an audio extra at ozarksatlarge.com, including what he thinks the future holds for newspapers and journalism.
But the need for information, it will never go away. Mm-hmm. And information has value. It has monetary value. And there'll always be people who are willing to pay money, to pay for reliable information with the emphasis on reliable.
That audio extra can be heard at OzarksAtLarge.com. Tuesday, October 9th, 2012. I'm Kyle Callum.
I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
With us is Becca Martin Brown, features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
If you've never met Susan Young, who's the outreach coordinator for the Shiloh Museum, or heard her speak, she's wonderful. And she's going to talk tonight about the roots of Ozark dialect.
Something she knows a lot about.
At the local chapter meeting of the Arkansas Archaeological Society. It happens at 7 o'clock at the Archaeological Survey Building in Fayetteville, and you are welcome there. To find out more, 575-3556. Or over at the Walton Arts Center, a musician often called the Gentle Giant, Don Williams, is in town. Songs like Tulsa Time, I Believe in You, and Good Old Boys Like Me. He also recorded the critically acclaimed 2012 album, And So It Goes. Mm-hmm. He'll be on stage at 7 o'clock, and tickets start at $35 at 443-5600.
That is where I will be tonight.
Thank you, Becca. Becca Martin Brown is features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
You're like us. You see people doing these crazy, ridiculous things, and you wonder, what were they thinking? On the next Snap Judgment from PRX and NPR, we're going to find out. Snap proudly presents Walk in My Shoes. Snap Judgment, storytelling with the beat. Do not miss it.
Snap Judgment, Saturday afternoon at 1 on KUAF 91.3 FM.
Sheila Heide's novel, How Should a Person Be?, was first published in the author's native Canada in 2010, but only first published in the U.S. within the past few months. Critics have hailed the book as a seriously strange but funny plunge into the quest for authenticity, and a book that risks everything, shatters every rule that women try to follow to be taken seriously, and groundbreaking. Her book, The Chairs Are Where People Go, co-authored with Misha Gluberman, was named one of the best books of 2011 by The New Yorker.
In her latest novel, the main character is a late 20-something named Sheila, who is trying, but ultimately failing to, write a commissioned feminist play. She lives in Toronto with a group of artists' friends who stay up all night, conduct an ugly painting contest, drink to excess, and, as Ozarks at Large's Katie Henriksen points out, have conversations about such things as the Statue of Liberty.
The conversation is written as though transcribed from a taped conversation. Margot, I just wish that she had a bit of what this girl has. Her freedom. Her shamelessness. Pause. You know, sometimes I get really excited thinking about autism. I think, oh, over there in Silicon Valley, there are all these kids with autism, and I think maybe it's an advantageous human trait. Maybe it's sort of wonderful to Sheila, to lack feelings. Margot, to lack an overwhelming empathy. I sometimes feel pretty paralyzed by my own feelings of empathy, and it's still such a problem. Shame. Maybe what I want in my life is to cut out a bit of the empathy and a bit of the shame. This conversation takes place between the two friends as they travel down to the giant contemporary arts exhibition Art Basel Miami Beach. And Margot is also a real-life friend of Hetty's and a painter. This book has had lots of notable reviews, including in the New York Times and the New Yorker, and also in the online publication The Los Angeles Review of Books, where Chris Krauss scrutinizes the novel, confessional, memoir, and what he describes as faux epic. It isn't to say that her struggle is fake. Quite the reverse. Hetty, who studied playwriting and theater rather than creative writing, is intensely aware of the dialectic that binds art with artifice, and goes on to discuss a friendship between Margot and Sheila, who suddenly left a brief marriage, saying it is this friendship that drives the book's narrative. Sheila also has a submissive relationship with a brooding artist named Israel. Find some satisfaction by working with her hands and treating others' hair at a salon. Quits to briefly move to New York in an attempt to really be an artist, only to return to Toronto, and the culmination of the ugly painting competition, all the while on a quest to answer how she should be. Does she ever figure it out? Not really, but that, in essence, is what makes the book's authenticity pertinent. This isn't tidy. It's a mess of narratives, faux transcriptions, and email conversations artfully arranged in a way that someone who studied theater, as Henny did at the National Theater School in Montreal before transferring to the University of Toronto to study art history and philosophy, could. Resolution, not so much, though it all comes back to the ugly painting competition at the final scene, with the penultimate chapter titled Gravedigger, in which she depicts a man who labored up at Mount Pleasant Cemetery and has a conversation with a ditch digger. The gravedigger gets the final say in the chapter when he says to himself, "Not everyone can be a gravedigger. You have to make a neat job of it. I met a man once. He dug ditches. He wanted to see a grave. He was impressed when he saw me digging this way, how straight and deep it was. I told him, it has to be. A human body is going in this grave." Hetty's How Should a Person Be is a satisfying and breezy read. Okay, breezy for someone like me. That is to say, there aren't a lot of long syllable words and the prose is pretty straightforward. Though the characters do discuss heady topics such as Nietzsche and Andy Warhol, the aesthetics of bad art, and how to become an artist in a day when the MFA machine, combined with the university trend towards adjunct labor, has created a generation of 30-somethings floating. We have no ground. We don't know where to go. We want to create, but we mostly want to figure out how to make rent each month, how to maintain satisfying relationships, when the world around us has become so meta that everything and nothing is real at the same time, and there is no such thing as authenticity. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Katie Hendrickson.
Katie Hendrickson reviewed the novel How Should a Person Be, written by Sheila Haiti.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Tuesday. It's the 9th of October, 2012. It's the birthday of Jill Kerr Conway, born in New South Wales, Australia, 1934. Father was a sheep rancher. She grew up in isolation on a sheep ranch, far, far from town. She became a sheep hand on the ranch, checking fences and prodding sheep from one paddock to another. Went off to college, studied history, and then spent 10 years as the president of Smith College, first woman to hold that position. She's the author of The Road from Kurrain and A Woman's Education. Jill Kerr Conway, who said, "You never know what you'll want to write until it starts writing itself in your head." It was on this day the Washington Monument was opened to the public. It had been 40 years in the building from 1848, opened on this day 1888. At the time, 550 feet high, it was the tallest building in the world. It's the birthday of James Howe McClure, born 1939, Johannesburg, South Africa. A journalist and a crime novelist. He wrote a series of crime novels in the Kramer and Zondi series set in South Africa, two detectives, one Afrikaner and one Zulu, and then wrote a couple of nonfiction books about police in Liverpool and police in San Diego. James Howe McClure, who said, "I long, long, long ago thought the finest thing to be is an entertainer, with tons of funny things to say. If people find lots more in my work, that's great. But if they just read and have a good laugh, that's fine for me." It's the birthday of the Irish poet Sharon Carson, 1948, in Belfast. Still lives there. His parents only spoke Irish at home, and the Carson children learned English playing in the streets with other children. Author of many books, including Belfast Confetti and Shamrock Tea. Sharon Carson, who said, "There's a whole language out there, and one's role as a writer is to stumble around in it." and it's the birthday of the composer Camille Saint-Saëns, born in Paris, 1835. Wrote 13 operas, of which the most famous, really the only one much performed, was Samson and Delilah. Toured frequently, playing his piano concertos all over Europe and the United States, accompanied by a servant and his pet dogs. Saint-Saëns, who said, "I like good company, but I like hard work even better." Here's a poem for today by Sharon Olds, entitled Parents' Day. I breathed shallow as I looked for her in the crowd of oncoming parents. I strained forward like a gaze hound held back on a leash. Then I raced toward her. I remember her being much bigger than I, her smile of the highest wattage, a little stiff, sparkling with consciousness of her prettiness. I pitied the other girls for having mothers who looked like mothers, who did not blush. Sometimes she would have braids around her head like a goddess or an advertisement for California raisins. I worshipped her cleanliness, her transfixing irises. Sometimes I thought she could sense a few genes of hers dotted here and there in my body, like bits of undissolved sugar in a recipe that did not quite work out. For years, when I thought of her, I thought of the long souring of her life. But on Parents' Day, my heart would bang and my lungs swell so I could feel the tucks and puckers of embroidered smocking on my chest press into my ribs, my washboard front vibrate like scraped tin, to see that woman arriving and to know she was mine. Parents' Day by Sharon Olds from The Wellspring, published by Knopf and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac. Supported by Reputation.com, a service for managing businesses' online image by working to improve how they look in search engines and review sites. Reputation.com. Written by Joy Biles, produced by Nick Vetter. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Support for KUAF comes from Walton Art Center and the 10x10 Art Series, welcoming Caravan Sarai, A Place Where Cultures Meet, on Thursday, October 18th. This concert of West African traditional music explores the soul of Morocco at Caravan Sarai and features the Majid Bekas Ganawa Ensemble and the Brahim Fribergani. Tickets and more information available at waltonartcenter.org or 443-5600.
Support for KUAF provided by the 7th Annual Cherokee Art Market, featuring 130 Native American artists, along with interactive cultural demonstrations October 13th and 14th inside Hard Rock Hotel and Casino in Tulsa. More information at CherokeeArtMarket.com. And the 24th Annual Chili Pepper Cross Country Race is Saturday at the University of Arkansas's cross country course in Fayetteville. Over 80 college teams and 120 high school teams will be competing, plus 750 runners will participate in the open 10K and 1 mile fun run. Registration, more information available at ChiliPepperFestival.org.
A listener-supported service of the Department of Journalism and Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Rogers, Fort Smith, Hurricane Grove.
Hurricane Grove.
Mm-hmm.
That is where?
Near Mount Ida.
Or, as the locals say, Mount Ida.
Oh, sorry.
That's okay. That's all right. I'm going to see Don Williams tonight at Walton Arts Center. Very excited about that.
Oh, yeah. That's tonight.
It is tonight.
Jeez, so many things.
So many things. Went to Fort Smith last night.
Yeah,
on a
how was
scores.
That?
A great drive over. And you're going to, I can't wait to see Dromnium, the latest from UAFS Theater.
And you're going to have a story on that tomorrow?
Tomorrow on Ozarks
okay,
at Large.
Okay, good.
Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Kyle Kellums.
And I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
Tomorrow on the show, mm-hmm. we'll give you a chance to win tickets to see the Avett Brothers. They're coming next week to the Amp. Have a great Tuesday.